Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and I'm here with
Madeleine Potter,
who is playing Amanda in the new production at Ford's Theater coming up on January 22nd through February 21st. Thanks so much for joining us on WTOP.
Very good to be here.
Now, first of all, let's go into like your backstory before we go into the play. You're from D.C., right? Whereabouts did you grow up around this area and before going to London?
I was here for bits of my childhood that were not spent overseas because my parents were diplomats. So.
Okay.
This is where we would return between foreign ports of call. And the first house was in Georgetown on Q Street, and then my mother moved to Capitol Hill. So, yes, and then I went to New York when I was very young. So I was in New York for some time before I went to London and had a career in New York.
So do you have more of your childhood memories or New York or D.C.? Can you barely – do you remember much of your time in D.C.?
I do. I remember my my childhood here and my adolescence. Yeah, you know, of course. I mean, Dumbarton Oaks, where I've been taking my spaniel to walk because he's come with me from London, is amazing. I mean, you never forget the architecture of a place. So even if you think, I mean, I'll suddenly find myself on a street and go, oh, it's really extraordinarily like bits of the play in that we don't really have control over memories. I mean, Dylan Thomas's great remark about the memories of childhood have no order and no end, but I will come around a corner and know exactly where I need to go, but not on a conscious level. And then suddenly the picture fills in, you know?
Yeah.
It's extraordinary.
Interesting. That's awesome. I like this idea of memory, because you called it a memory play.
Yes.
Tennessee Williams did.
Yes.
But let's go into the play, and you and I know what it's about, you know, set in St. Louis apartment, right?
That's right, tenement. They're very poor. It's the Depression. Poverty is, one of the most important elements of the actual setting. I mean, this was during the Depression. People had nothing. So they are living in very reduced circumstances.
Yeah. How do you think that dynamic affects the... you know, the desire to have someone come over and court the daughter, and, you know, how does the poverty play into the end of the actual plot?
Well, I think it could never be emphasized enough. I also think that poverty is a thing that, unless experienced, is difficult for people to imagine. And so in a work of art of this magnitude, you know, it's our duty, of course, to try to live all those things to the very, very best of our abilities. But there's absolutely no question that, you know, people were selling pencils to survive. And because, I mean, most people know the story of the play, but the father left when the children were small, and the mother would have been in the 1920s as a very young woman with two small children, left with almost no options in terms of employment. That's changed a little bit, of course, now, but if you have children even now and you're left by yourself, it presents a lot of challenges. So, you know, that is also, that's all in there.
Yeah.
And indeed, he mentions it in his very first speech, this character that never appears, but that but whose action years ago drove so many things. So to get back to your question, there are not very many options. The mother is inventive and extremely determined. That's her personality, but also she has her children. She has to be, you know, forceful for their sake. And she's the, you know, and then he's now, Thomas, just old enough to, you know, be the breadwinner. So it's, that is a sort of, from that everything comes. And then the daughter really doesn't have many options. People didn't in those days.
Right.
It would have been expected of me in the late teens of you know, in 1918, after the First World War, whatever, you know, that I would marry. I think what was not expected was that I would marry a telephone man. I mean, she obviously went completely against her whole family and everything that she was raised for. She was supposed to make a brilliant marriage to somebody with lots and lots of land and had a lot of options, but she fell in love with that one. And and so, yes, it is incredibly important because of how few options there are and also how few... Well, I was going to say... all these things have to do also with character and not only with circumstance, but the circumstances are extraordinarily challenging for all of the characters in the play.
Yeah. Well, you said circumstance versus character, so I think we went really heavily into the circumstance, but let's pivot now to the character.
Okay.
Take me into your relationship with your onstage son, Tom. What is that dynamic like? And also with you working with who plays him?
Tom Story. He's lovely.
Awesome.
It's a fascinating relationship. I mean, one of the things, I suppose, about doing a famous play is that one often grows up with, I mean, we all grow up with certain attitudes towards the characters, you know, certain ideas, you know. Yep. And one of the best things I ever read is on the wall of the Royal Court Theatre in London.
On the wall as in, like, repeated or a plaque?
Well, when they redid the court,
okay,
there's a kind of, it is actually framed,
okay,
but they did redo it in such a way that you can see all the old brick. Have you been there?
Oh, nice.
It's really weird that you said,
yeah, to, yeah,
when they remade it, all of it is kind of exposed, the structure of the place.
Okay.
It's fascinating. But anyway, no, it's on a big, huge thing, and it basically says, all new plays should be treated as classics. All classics should be treated as new plays.
That's pretty genius.
Which I think is absolutely brilliant. So one has certain attitudes. And it was actually my own daughter who revealed this play to me some years ago. She was 15 or 16 a few years ago, and she was in secondary school. And she wrote what I thought was an absolutely brilliant essay about the glass menagerie. She doesn't consider it to be brilliant, but it was what she saw.
Yeah.
And fascinatingly, she saw it completely from the mother's perspective.
Wow.
So I never thought of it one way or another.
Well, you had seen it long before that, right?
I have seen the play, not in a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. I saw it on stage a couple of times when I was, you know, like a child, mm-hmm. and once when I was a teenager. And then I've seen sort of snippets of movies, but that would be something that I would avoid as soon as I had in front of me that I was given a role. Mm-hmm. Because when you look at the play, and of course, you know, there are elements of autobiography, but it is also a work of fiction. It's a work of art. And for me, I think everything that you need is given in the play. It's such an extraordinary piece of writing. And it continually reveals itself. And one wants to keep trying to find something that's absolutely true, connect to what it is specifically with the people who are in front of you. So, you know, Tom is my Tom, mm-hmm. and Jenna is, you know, Laura,
yeah.
and Thomas is the gentleman caller, and they are those people to me. But it's a fascinating relationship that the mother and son, I mean, in some ways they're alike.
Yeah.
They're both, his language, I have noticed, in his speeches, which is him as an older man, mm-hmm. when he comes and directly addresses the audience, you know, he's
right.
he's in a kind of present with the audience, and then he goes back and he's inside the world of his past that he's trying to understand. And
yeah, what is this big line? It's in the beginning, it's like a magician, but the opposite of a magician. A magician wants to reveal, take truth and disguise, or take,
yeah.
you know, fiction and disguise as truth, but I'm going to do the opposite. It's something like that.
And
anyway,
disguise,
yeah,
yes, it's
yeah,
a,
yeah, yeah.
a beautiful, amazing
right.
speech,
yeah.
yes, about that. And also, just, you know, what is memory? Because there are, anyway, to talk
yeah,
about
yeah.
Tom and Man, so there's so much to talk about with this
yeah,
play,
because yeah.
it's such an incredible,
it's all right.
incredible
we'll go,
play.
We'll go on tangents and bring it on back.
yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But, I mean, it's fascinating to me that his speeches as an older man looking back, have some of the rhythm and language of his mother, and even quotes her. He quotes things
we
in
all
the
quote
present
our
with the,
even if we don't realize it.
Exactly. exactly. And there's and also a relationship when growing up, or any relationship, when then looked upon from a span of years, means something completely different.
Right.
So yeah, they have, you know, when they get along, it's an incredibly creative relationship. You know, and when they don't get along, they don't
yeah.
get along. They
right.
rub up against each other because they are in some ways similar, and in, you know, in other ways not. But it's fascinating. I mean, it's just such great writing. So
much
a rise to
yeah,
it. Yeah,
yeah, definitely.
It's juicy. Yeah.
Okay, now let's go with you and your daughter. You mentioned how your real life daughter and sort of, you know, helped you recontextualize the play for yourself. But what about you and your on stage daughter?
All the other actors are excellent,
yeah.
and she's wonderful. She's a wonderful actress, and it's a pleasure, you know, to work with her and all of them. Actually, they're very, very good.
Yeah.
Lucky.
What was it about your daughters? You said, was it like a term paper on the play, or what
it was,
was
just
it?
An essay.
Yeah.
If she ever hears this, she would be very angry. Possibly for bringing it up. But it was insightful. And she was looking at it with no what my brother Paul, my brilliant brother Paul, used to call without received understanding. She was looking at it with new eyes. Mm. So like that royal court saying, I think it's right. terribly important. Here's the thing. The drama that interests me in terms of doing it or watching it is the drama in which I recognize the humanity of everybody. Mm-hmm. And I recognize myself in everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a recent production in London of the Oresteia, an adaptation of the Oresteia by Robert Icke, which was absolutely phenomenal. And I've played Clytemnestra twice. And even before I ever played Clytemnestra, I thought Agamemnon was really creepy. I mean, he kills his daughter. And all I really ever thought about him was, you need to die.
Right.
And right. you know, in the context of the play.
Of the play.
But in this play, he made you, in the most extraordinary way, look at how the man is caught. I mean, it's a modern adaptation, but it's phenomenally Greek in its essence. It's
right.
brilliant.
Okay.
So come see it. But for the first time, I looked at Agamemnon and his brother convincing him that he had no right to go to war unless he did do this thing, that he was asking other people to kill their children, but he was not unwilling right. to get. And I saw this
you
man.
You see the motivation.
Yes,
that, yeah.
get caught yeah. in a logic he could not escape from. Mm-hmm. It was terrifying and extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And so, and you really could see every, I mean, you know, it's. I think it's great when you see
right.
everybody
as
going for what they're going
human.
For.
Yeah,
None
yeah,
of us
yeah.
know
yeah.
what right. we're going to do. We wake up in the morning, or as a friend of mine says, a 20-year marriage can end in a 15-minute conversation. But you don't generally go into that conversation expecting that that will be the case. In fact, you almost never do unless you plan to go.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And that's what's happening in this play, I think.
Mm-hmm.
This person, this man, Tom, is attempting to understand and keeps having to revisit it because he needs to understand what happened and when.
Mm-hmm. What is it? You've said it several times here, the idea of memory, but what is that the key to Tennessee Williams? What makes him such a brilliant writer in your mind?
This is the first I've ever done, but I would love to do Streetcar and Sweet Bird of Youth. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's such an amazing writer. When this came up and I was going to speak to Mark, from our director from London, I read them all again, you know, or anyway, I read several
right.
again and was just blown away by it. I mean, what's great about him, he's extraordinarily sensitive. He's never obvious. And I imagine that writing a play, I mean, in terms of autobiography, people will look at that and make intellectual connections like that. But it okay. seems to me that, like the process, like any artistic process, you know, like painting something
mm-hmm.
or acting in something, also writing something, that the unconscious comes into play
mm-hmm.
and that you begin one place and end up somewhere unexpected. I mean, he's in all of his characters.
Yeah.
He understands this thing about women and the position of women in society is something that I have never really heard discussed about this play at all, which fascinates me because he was so aware of the limited opportunities
mm-hmm.
for women of any age. And it's all over this play.
It's woven in there, but why do you think no one has talked about it that much?
That's a really great question.
Maybe that reflects more on society.
I think you're right. And I think some things haven't changed. I was just talking to Sam, one of our lovely, incredible stage management crew. They're all extraordinary. And I was saying, you know, it's that whole, you know, have you ever asked a boy out? Or do you expect, you know, or do you wait to be? I mean, there are so many things. We still don't get equal pay. It's a lot better than it was in the Depression in the 1930s. But there are still, and obviously not only in this society, but all over the world, there are massive inequalities. So anyway, I think he was interested. He was very interested in that. Neither Amanda nor Laura have the option to go join the merchant seamen if they wanted to. Do you know what I'm
right,
saying?
Right, exactly. No.
It's the palette for opportunity is too narrow. And the idea, I think he understood deeply and profoundly what it is to be a woman and have to wait and wait, and wait, and wait, and cope,
and wait,
and try never to give up. I mean, Amanda is an optimist with a capital O and doesn't like to give up. And she's extroverted with introverted children, which is common. They tend to go like that, you know?
Just one drive, the other two. Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, and I just think it kind of works that way. I don't know. Probably. But anyway, so it's really. Yeah, I mean, there's so much in the play, including what we just discussed, which I've never had really long discussions about this play, and I didn't go to drama school.
Right. Wait, how were you trained?
I began acting very young.
Nice.
Yeah, so I learned on the fly. I now sometimes lecture.
Yeah.
Yes, I now lecture in drama school and teach in drama schools and direct in drama schools and love to direct. Yeah. And it's an incredible privilege to teach, and I learned so much from
so you
them.
You learn by doing.
Yes, yeah. But I didn't. I mean, my daughter's in an amazing acting program in Manchester, and she was talking about, you know, the class yesterday, and they were talking about Chekhov, and it was amazing. And I love being the teacher in those circumstances and playing with, you know, people, but I never had that. So I never had any sort of long discussion about, you know, Tennessee Williams and, you know, the glass manager and Isa Oddbody, you know, up until now. But I did have this absolutely brilliant brother who used to take me to plays. And one time, ages and ages ago, he took me to
Is this in New York or in London?
No, this was here.
Okay.
He in America, he took me to a production when I was little. So I can't remember where it was.
Yeah.
And I asked him if he liked it, and I didn't like it. It was this play. And he said something like, there was something wrong with the tableware. Because the thing is, you see, that in the 1930s, many more things were made by hand. And so there was more poetry in general in all of existence.
And you're looking up at brother and going, Ben.
Well, I knew he was a genius already. So I was just drinking it all in as much as I could.
Yeah.
But I know what he means. And
drinking
the more
it in
I think
out of
about
a handmade
that,
glass, of course.
And there's something about that. I mean, there is a whole theme as well. There are so many themes in the play. I mean, because it's so deeply and profoundly about human experience, there are, of course, we can find infinite themes in it because it's so, so rich on a human level. But, you know, there is this whole thing about, the fact that the director was talking about it in rehearsal the other day, but this whole sort of, you know, conflict between the age of more poetry, the harvest, versus the age of the machine.
Right.
So we've had the Industrial Revolution now for some time, and now we're in a really dark, awful
revolution.
Exactly. But that was the beginning of it.
Right.
It has now exponentially grown, you know. But, I mean, John Millington Synge talks about it, too, in his preface to Playboy of the Western World, you know, when the harvest is a memory only and the straw has been turned into bricks. You know, the notion of people not being able to live a life that has to do with being connected to nature and having space to breathe, but being shoved into these massive imaginations. All three of these people in this family have these massive, extraordinary imaginations, all of them.
Yeah.
And they're forced into this gray, tiny tenement, and their, you know, daily existence is so opposite, you know.
It's a cool way to look at it. I like that.
Yeah.
The harvest versus the, What's in Amanda's imagination? If you could see in what she desires for herself outside of this little crammed existence with these three people, what do you think she'd be doing?
You mean if she weren't there?
Yeah.
If she had had a different life?
Yeah.
That's a very interesting question, and one that did come up in rehearsal. She's definitely a star that deserves a larger stage. You know, there is just an incredible creative imagination in the woman, the way she speaks, her use of language. And, you know, the stories. I mean, there is this sort of drive against, refusal to give in to circumstance. And to keep bringing in always the notion of this poetry. And I think this is deeply in Tennessee Williams, from what I understand of him. I didn't meet him, but I do know people who did know him. And you can feel it anyway in his work, you know, that this notion of, what is, it's an Emily Dickinson poem, hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the song without the words and never stops at all. This sort of defiance against ugliness, Tom's incredible description of where he works and how awful it is, the light, and the sort of arid, absent of poetry, absent of thought, you know, absent of whimsy, absent of beauty, all important to Amanda.
Yeah.
You know, there's a great remark by Alain de Botton, this French writer, beauty is the promise of happiness. And there is this thing about not giving in, which I completely identify with. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't choose your circumstances, but you can choose how you dwell within them. And I think she wakes up every morning and goes to war for that. You know, probably that's what's written, I think.
That's awesome and profound. You're just, how are you plucking these quotes from Dickinson and everything? I mean, it's like it's all stored up there. Yeah, no, it's amazing.
I'm interested in language. Yeah. But I did have this, you know, I had, my mother was, read me things when I was very young. I mean, I remember her reading me the Iliad when I was like 4 years old, mm-hmm. and being absolutely entranced. She was an historian, really. She had many languages and was also very brilliant. So was that. And so when she traveled with us, you know, she would take us to places. And I remember like standing in Mycenae speaking of Agamemnon and her going, "This is the Lion Gate." And there was Agamemnon coming up with Cassandra, and Clytemnestra was standing. And I was like, oh, you know. Yeah. And so I've always been interested in language. And when I think when you, or at any rate when I, Madeline, read something that is really, that strikes me to the core, I tend to remember it.
Yeah. Cool. How about we've gotten a lot into the language and, you know, the writing of the play, but how about the staging here, what you guys are developing now? I mean, obviously, right now we're in Barracks Row in Shakespeare, you know, in rehearsal space, but once we get over to Ford's, who's directing it, and you know, and what's, is it like sort of a minimal set, since is it all confined in the one space? You know, take me into the visual of it.
I mean, I will insofar as I can, but of course I haven't seen it yet. I've heard it described, and I've seen pictures of it, and I've seen obviously the model of the set that we have in the room. But you know, Mark Ramont, our director, has been working on this for a long time with the designers, and it looks to be an absolutely extraordinary design that answers the play existing in kind of different forms. You know, one is a kind of realism in the playing of it, but it is also this a suspended sort of play about memory. So it sort of goes in and out of different. And I think the set really answers that. I mean, all the designers that I've met, the costume designer, Frank, that was just, is absolutely extraordinary. They all are really brilliant, and the music is beautiful. John Gramada. So we're very lucky in our team, and I'm not going to see it until Friday.
Wow.
And I think Friday, when we see it, we're doing our second ever run today. So we're still in, you know, we're still very much working on the text. And we have a lot of time in tech. It's a very long tech. We have days there to really explore the set, which is great because, of course, it completely changes when you get into, you know, what the actual space, world is. Yes, and begin to touch that and familiarize yourself with it. It's an amazing part of the process. Shocking, and always, and also, you know, thrilling and amazing. So.
So if your big brother came and saw it, would he have any? Would he say that silverware wasn't handmade?
Yeah. Probably not. I think I think everyone's on the same page about that here.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. I'm excited to go see it.